The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
I'm Brett.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, another pitcher comes to bat. Peter goes up the stack. Julie and it just don't look right. Simpson gets more bad advice. Doug goes advisory. More frauds against the odds, and much more, only on The Cyber Show. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
Fred here. On April 4th, we have our monthly advisory call for Angel to Exit. Join us to discuss anything you want about your early stage company. Later that day, we'll have the CEO's Forum, where portfolio company CEOs get together and discuss issues and help each other identify synergistic improvements. On April 11th, go to Angel. You can pitch your company, get in front of investors, get on the radio show, and tell the world about your new company. Also on April 11th, the All.net Members Forum. You can meet with cybersecurity experts from around the world and discuss all sorts of interesting things. For more details, go to thecybershow.co.
For details on anything you hear about at The Cyber Show, go to thecybershow.co.
This segment's called The Pitch. In The Pitch, a company presents in the hopes that you, the listening audience, will find them interesting enough to go the next step.
Hi, everybody, and a very pleasant Wednesday to you, wherever you may be.
Sandy into his windup. Here's The Pitch.
So we have Yvonne from Bastion. Tell us what your company does.
Hi, everyone. So we do machine identity management for critical operations and assets.
Hang on. Wait a minute. Way too complicated. What is machine identity management, please?
Machine identity management and your general identity and access management is the first most important layer of security that keeps the bad actors out of your systems. I like to think of it like as a lock that you put on the front of your door. So that is your lock and someone needs a key in order to get into your house or through the lock.
Okay, so when you say machine identity management, you know, that's three big words, right? Each more than one syllable. Identity is presumably something that associates a machine with something it's supposed to do or not supposed to do or allowed to do or not allowed to do, right? So that's machine identity. Which machine is it? And then the other part is management. Does that make sense?
Yes, that does, yeah.
What kind of machines do you deal with?
So currently we do machines related to critical operations and assets. So anything within your company that has potentially chaotic effects if you are unable to determine the correct privileged access for the machine. So something...
Hang on. Again, when you say machines, does this include, for example, my cell phone?
Yeah, it's your cell phone.
But my desktop computer.
Yeah, your desktop computer.
The router that connects me to the internet.
Absolutely, the router included.
My servers up in Amazon Web Services.
Yeah, the service too.
My IoT devices, right? My ring thing that's on my front door with the camera.
Yeah, funny that you mentioned that one, but yes, we do that too. For those of you that don't know, Ring obviously had quite an incident recently. So,
yeah, so what you're really talking about is any physical thing that is a computer that's connected to something else, you somehow are able to identify it, right?
Yes.
And then control access to it or control what it can access somewhere else?
Both of those. So that goes into the general access management side. And we also do privileged access management. So that includes, what privileges does this device have to connect with another device and request data and et cetera.
Right. So one of the big problems that we see in the infrastructure, you know, this put Facebook out, I guess, for 8 or 12 hours or something is, one of their network administrators accidentally changed something in Border Gateway Protocol. So they ended up, you know, not being able to communicate to the rest of the internet. So presumably they were authorized. But if you had this in place, then maybe your management system would say no individual working for our company can take us off the internet for 8 to 12 hours. Is that what we're talking about?
Yes, exactly just that. So that would go into your privileged access. So hopefully only a C-level executive or someone high up in the company has that kind of authority, not a random guy who just decided to fool around with the printer for a day or something like that.
Yeah, well, no, but I mean, normally this is the network engineer, and frankly, the CEO doesn't have a clue in almost any company you're going to name that's a Facebook site about whether or not I should change the border gateway protocol to put this address associated with that information transfer between our autonomous systems, right? So somehow managing that process is the very tricky part. So what do you do for the management side of it?
For the management side, we do advise metric key stuff. So that's kind of where the security stuff comes to play. But then we use technology to associate the unique identity of the device with the unique symmetric key. So the corresponding identity and the symmetric key need to match in order to be able to successfully decrypt data, for one, and also to establish connections.
So, Yvonne, obviously your information is on the webpage. You're doing a raise for investors, and only accredited investors are allowed to look at stuff. So the link on the cybershow.co will click through to your GWiz, your growth wizards, and they can look at your company and get information about it and contact you there.
The perfect game.
For more details on this pitch and to view their GWiz, go to thecybershow.co and click on their listing.
That was absolutely amazing.
Breaking news on the Cyber Show. The FUD index reached 8.2 to 9.3 today, indicating the highest range since the index was created. Representing fear, uncertainty, and doubt, the FUD index is the key indicator of how cyber is going on a global basis. The FUD 256 comprising the index, doubling from the FUD 128 of only a year ago. More on this critical story soon.
And now a word from our sponsor. Tuesday, April 11th, go to Angel. Pitch your company to investors, get a global listing, and get on the Cyber Show. Sign up at a2e.co.
To get in touch with companies presenting on the show, you can go to thecybershow.co and look them up. During this segment of the show, we talk to historical figures from the cyber world. We're discussing the history of the cyber world with Peter Neumann. His long career exemplifies a great deal of the time and effort and expertise involved in the development of the cyber world that we live in today.
Well, that sort of gets us into the Cherry architecture, which is one in which we have been able to build a system that has a set of something like 23 principles. Salzer and Schroeder came up with a small number from the Multics years. And this is probably the most principled system ever designed. We designed it so that it could be, the properties could be proven. The hardware is formally specified.
So it has high assurance of certain properties under some set of specified circumstances.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, which is what you want, predictability.
Yeah. Okay. And the byproduct.
So now that, but Peter, that might be really good for hardware and software of limited types, because once you start writing software on top of it, you know, the software is crap.
Now you see, then you get to memory management. Microsoft came to us and said that basically 70% of all of their many vulnerabilities are memory management problems. And if they were to run Windows, for example, on our hardware, all of those would go away. Because the hardware.
Except they probably exploit those problems to do some functionality, which probably would not work anymore as well. But that's another issue.
That is probably the case. But the point was, if you were designing something today to be in C or C++, for example, if you use our hardware, a lot of the memory management problems disappear. And we've done research extensively on speculative execution, and we show that we can control many of those.
That's a much more difficult issue, right? Because it's not just speculative execution. There's nothing fundamentally wrong with that. But there are all sorts of problems that it introduces that they just didn't think about when they introduced it.
That's right. Well, the idea was you want to make the computer faster and faster and faster.
Yeah.
And
well,
if you pre-fetch,
they pay a price, right? You know,
prefetch all sorts of stuff that you might need in the future.
That's part of the hard part, but there's another hard part, and that is if you include timing as part of your security requirement,
right,
then you can detect the timing differentials based on what the prior execution.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you get
it's not going to be fixed by all this other stuff you're doing.
You get covert channels all over the place. But if you build, go back to Multics in 1965. we solved the so-called buffer overflow problem.
Guess what? We still have it.
The hardware prevented you from executing anything that wasn't in the immediate stack frame.
Yeah. However, we still have the problem.
Well, that's because everybody else ignored it. And they said it's not a real
problem. Exactly, right? That's my point.
Yeah, when I get to
my point is, people don't learn because they don't read the risks for them.
Yeah. So when I get to my book in 1995, everything in my book today is still happening today because people are ignoring everything that's in the book.
This is one of the things about all aspects of security. All right. So you're talking about low-level hardware, software, really thoughtful things. But the same has to apply for a trustworthy system to the human and then groups of humans and organizational structure and social structure on top of that.
Yep.
And what we're facing now is this amplification of disinformation.
Well, we're dealing with anarchy. We're basically dealing with anarchy. When anybody can write
it's an attempt to get there. Yeah.
Anybody can write a piece of code in whatever language they like. And now they think they're software engineers.
Well, that's a naming issue, right? So, but you're staying in the software world, and I'm saying in the cognitive world that all this has to operate in, we have the same problem.
Of course.
And because of the integration of computers and the dissemination of information through them, there's an amplification effect of all the social vulnerabilities.
Oh, yeah.
And all the cognitive vulnerabilities of humans. So if you want to have a trustworthy system, it's not just the hardware and software of the computers. You also have to get the memes to be reliable. And then it comes to a question of your view of what the future should be versus theirs.
Yeah, we end up with screaming memes.
But what we end up with is a function of what we architect in our complex society of people fighting against each other for whatever.
Yeah.
And so that is the problem that you're nowhere near solving.
Well, now you've gotten to the point.
But I just want to mention, the reason I bring this up is because I don't think you're ready to retire once you get this hardware, software stuff done.
I know.
We have 150 years to work on this.
We've got a long way to go.
Yeah. So you're still working on grants for like 2040, right?
Probably.
Well, maybe the day will come when we get to work together on some of these things. But in the meanwhile, people on the radio get to hear what it's like when we have a conversation.
Yeah, that's great. I think there's a long way to go. Part of it's educational, because universities today no longer teach things like Multics did in the MIT days.
They don't teach ethics either. Okay, now, Brett, I'm going to ask you about my expanded version of the cyber issue, which is oh, no.
Yeah, I think I there were a couple things in what Peter had to say there that I'd like to comment on. One is, first, we'll just work backwards, ethics. Ethics are part of university courses these days in many fields, but including computer science. We, at the university I teach at, we have ethics topics built into quite a few of the courses that we offer. On artificial intelligence, cybersecurity, networking, software engineering, and so on. So I think you can't generalize too much. There's this idea of, you know, people making the same mistakes over and over, but really you can't assume that we have a homogeneous, set of people and organizations out there that are doing system development and maintenance. We have large organizations that are well-funded, that have their own internal research and development programs, that have the money to train and educate their staff and you know, best practices, and encourage that have the funding to actually encourage people to obtain professional certificates, like you mentioned. And but then you have, you know, the lower tiers, where there you have a small number of people or a medium-sized company that just doesn't have those same resources, and they do the best they can. You know, they make, I won't say they do the best they can, but they make conscious business decisions that, with the funds they have, and they have to turn a profit to stay or at least break even to stay in business. They do only, they make the engineering trade-offs to do, to build systems good enough to stay in business. Maybe not good. Maybe they're not really the best systems. Yeah. And then problems with, we know that the problem of covert channels is something of an unsolvable problem in many contexts. It's a hard problem to ensure that a system doesn't have any covert channels. The system has to be really trivial and not too useful to be able to show that the system doesn't have
covert channels. It's not just covert channels, right?
Yeah, it's memory management.
There are lots and lots and lots of cybersecurity problems that are potentially unsolvable. In fact, if you're looking for unsolvable problems, cybersecurity is an awfully good place to start.
Yes.
But beyond that, we still don't even have good definitions. And without definitions, we have an unlimited number of problems, including the problem of what the heck are we talking about when we talk about cybersecurity.
And it's also hard to manage trust, right? Because you don't, you have to have something against which to
measure.
A reference, for measurement.
Yeah. But now all of that, you know, you're just talking about hardware, software, computer stuff. Now we have, you know, all of this stuff has translated into the entire society. Mm-hmm. All of human endeavor is now at stake. And we have this enormous amplification associated with cybernetic technology that allows us to amplify all the problems of humanity, individuals and groups and organizations and global communities. And we have to address that whole set of problems, because it doesn't matter if your technology was somehow perfect at doing whatever it is it's supposed to do. It doesn't change the fact that people are getting harmed by other people. And that those systems are, even if they're doing what they're supposed to do, still being used to exploit other people.
Yeah, I guess a modern example is the use of AI for determining who can receive credit and not receive credit for, purchasing a home or a car or whatever. And there's this concern about building in bias into the algorithms, so that certain
or who gets a job.
Yes, exactly.
Or who earns how much money.
Or who is considered an insider threat.
Or who can buy a house.
Yeah. So, yes.
Yeah. So all of society moving towards this cybernetic environment we've created is drawing all these challenges, all these limitations we have associated with cybernetic systems into the greater social environment and amplifying it beyond what has ever been seen by humanity or any other, as far as we're aware, living system on the planet, and at a faster pace and at larger scale. So I think there may be some issues. You know, I think we're going to have something to do for the rest of our careers, no matter how long they last.
Yes, there's plenty to do. It's definitely a lifetime endeavor that outlasts our lifetime.
For those of you that don't know, on the Risks Forum, every April 1st, the forum features April Fool's postings. Since we have Peter on, and Peter runs the Risks Forum, I thought this week, April 1st coming up over the weekend, we would read some historical April Fool's from the Risks Forum. From April 1st, 1988, we have Russian computers, for historic reasons most forged messages have as part of their path, a non-existent, we think, Russian computer, either Kremvax or Moskvax. Other possibilities are NSA Cyber or Wobegon. Please note, however, that Waldrug is a real site and isn't a forgery. Here's one from April 1st, 1989. Newsweek. I must set a proper example. Interviewed on McNeil Lear's show yesterday, the president nominee for head of the Office of War Addiction said that if confirmed, he will abstain from the use of his private Macintosh while he is in office. March 20th, AP, Murray Hill, New Jersey. At a meeting of Hackers Anonymous last evening, well-known computer science C.A.R. Cutter declared, "I am a hackaholic." And this one from 1991. There has been a recent attempt to break into our system. From operator, root at hilda.umd.edu. This is the system administration. Because of security faults, we request that you change your password to system 001. The change is mandatory and should be done immediately. So now that you have a sense of what it's all about, if you'd like to send your April Fool's comment to the Risks Forum, go to thecybershow.co, click on the Risks Forum, and arrange to join and send an email. You're running out of time, so do it now. Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies. This is a little segment of the show we call Cyber Cops. Cyber cops are the police officers and other law enforcement officials who police the cyber world. And this is their story. So what you want to do for effective frauds is you want to generate lower amounts in different amounts so that it's not systematic. But then you run into this other law that has to do with random number generation versus real number generation, right? What's the name of that law? Do you remember?
There's a law that says that? I'm not aware
of
it.
It's not a legal law. It's a mathematical law.
Oh, you mean Ben? I can't remember the name. I never found it very effective in detecting fraud, to be honest with you.
Right.
Yeah, I think it's Benford's law.
Benford's law. That's right.
Yeah, I think that's what you're referring to.
Yeah. So you don't tend to use that one because you didn't find that effective. Were there other ones that you used?
No, I mean, it would be more like when I was reviewing the financial statements. Okay, if I was looking at the, for example, the annual report form 5500, that's essentially the tax return for an employee benefit plan. So looking at what's been reported on those item lines or line items would actually, there would be things that were really inconsistent. So you would see things and then that would lead you to believe that there was something wrong, like especially like for the incurred but not yet reported claims, okay, amounts, if the amounts were super low. That was like a, you know, flag that there was something going on, especially when you had other complaints about not getting claims paid. So, you know, so because the claims tail is really long on health claims and also on casualty claims. So, it goes up exponentially. So it's like a geometric, you know, rise. And so those were actually more useful than.
You looked at the statistics of these things?
I looked at the financial reporting on it, okay, like what they're reporting in dollars, okay? So you could tell that something was going on and that wasn't quite right. It was off. So that's when you would want to look into it more deeply. And, you know, and also whatever the actuarial report may have said originally. So you got kind of some pointers in the right direction as opposed to...
This is JDLR. Just don't look right.
Well, you know, I remember you saying... You know, like it does take a human look for certain things. Okay. And based on your experience, when you're seen enough of it, you're like, this doesn't look right. There's something missing from this picture. And then when you start asking questions, you get, you know, responses that are not really based on the normal operations of that kind of entity. And so then you know that, okay, keep digging for what you're doing. And
This is one of the things we found in our research on insider turning behavior.
Right. Correct.
You get inconsistencies and the inconsistencies are related to the cover up, right? It's not.
Yeah, it's the deception to hide what's going on because they had to evade and avoid. So when you have controls in place and then you have someone doing, you know, kind of that knows it and does these other things, there's a flags raised is what we call it. So it raises some flags and then you need to look for.
Yeah, but you don't have actual flags. It raises some flags in your brain, right?
Right. But that's what we call it when we're looking at it. Okay. Like when you're doing initial investigation or you're doing initially get some information, that's kind of the things that raise some flags that lead you to believe that you're, you know, it's reasonable suspicion that a crime looks like it's being committed exactly how and exactly in the amount and, you know, are areas to be determined by further investigation.
That can't be right. I remember the same thing seems to be true in a lot of things way, way back when. I remember there was a bunch of traffic supposedly coming from Russia towards one of the national laboratories. And I said, well, so show me the audit trails from this. So I look at the audit trail from this and a sequence of packets. And they're, you know, like however many, 12 milliseconds apart, really 12 milliseconds, not 12.5, 12.8, 11, 12, whatever the number was. Within a, you know, a tenth or a hundredth of a millisecond each. And I said, this cannot be coming from Russia. There's just no way, right? They're lying about the IP address because you can't get packets from Russia that consistently because there's more jitter than that in the timing.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, you know, I don't have a mathematical formula that calculates jitter from Russia. Well, I guess I could do a statistical study of it. But just when you see enough of this stuff, you look at it and say, no, can't be true. And that's that GDLR trigger.
Yeah, that would be correct.
Got it. Perfect. We'll be telling more stories from Cyber Cops in our next show. So don't miss it. Next Wednesday, 9 a.m. Pacific Time, KMBY, 1240 a.m. And on the web at thecybershow.co.
And now a word from our sponsor.
Tuesday, April 11th, go to Angel. pitch your company to investors, get a global listing, and get on the Cyber Show. Sign up at a2e.co.
Frauds, spies, and lies, and how to defeat them. It's the name of a book, and now it's the name of a segment on our show. In today's session on fraud, spies, and lies, we're not going to take on a single piece of spam or fraud or anything like that. The reason is there's such a high volume of these things. Going one after another is just a waste of time in some sense. Let's just get a sense. I'm going to go over a bunch of them. Here's one that's increasingly being used. This one that has the subject reference from whoever it's from. And it's, I have your email from LinkedIn. Let me know if it's okay for me to forward you details of a proposal to your email here. So I've seen a lot of these lately. Regardless of what the subject is, they're asking permission to email me something at this email address. And of course, part of the problem here is, why are you sending me an email to ask me permission to send you an email? Just send your email. Every one I've seen so far, they tend to be frauds. Another very common one is an authentication notification saying, you know, your password has expired from Office. Only it's not for Microsoft, but it's Office 365 password. Please, you know, keep the same password. Click here so you can type in your password. Okay, so that's obviously trying to take a password. And on and on and on. You know, there's the question of, you know, what do you do to sort of counter this mass of these things coming at you? And so, you know, part of the answer is just not to answer them. And your package could not be delivered. Click here. Your insurance covers blah, 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 blah. Same thing. Urgent action needed. Permanent abandonment. Time is running out. There's also obviously things for, you know, best practices for securing this, you know, click here for this thing. So generally speaking, they're trying to influence you to triggering some belief based on something that you have in place. They don't know what you have in place. They're just assuming that you have that in place. Some people that have it in place will answer them. The way to, you know, look at these and understand them is probably just to go to your spam box, because there are plenty of them there. Another increasingly common thing is that you'll see them using names of somebody you've communicated with before, which means somehow they've gotten access to some mechanism by which you have communicated with other people and use the same name. And then you occasionally get, you know, something that's actually to you in your spam box. And this is the other problem with spam, that, you know, you get a lot of these emails that should be going into your email box, but go into the spam box. So you really have to check your spam filter to bring back in the legitimate emails. Another good indicator is the dear customer, dear so-and-so, the anonymous, whatever, unlisted, the no recipient identifier, and so forth. So these are, generally speaking, I'm just going to toss them all out. And then you can look at the correspondence. So I know I don't have anything with Coinbase, but I have, what, 8 emails here from Coinbase all within, you know, a couple hours of each other. For some reason, you know, I have no idea why anybody at Coinbase would want to talk to me, because I'm generally opposed to almost anything at Coinbase. You know, and then you get the business proposal. Good morning. My name is such and such attached to this email as a partnership proposal. Oh, important pending messages. You have pending messages that you haven't received. You won't be able to receive them unless you click here. A new fax received with your refund. Oh, yep, that's another common one. A payment error. Someone just sent you a private document complaint, blah, 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 blah. Password expiration request. Okay. Server such and such expired on this date. You know, send us a payment or confirm your account here. Payment remittance from city council. I don't see why I should be paying a city council anything. I don't live in a city for one thing, but, you know, security alert. Your crypto wallet, blah, blah, blah. Okay. Same thing. So basically, if you have any of these things and you get any of these alerts, you should probably just assume that the alerts are a bunch of baloney. The problem, of course, is that there may be legitimate alerts. And we've talked about this before. The way you deal with what might be a legitimate email is you contact them, but not by clicking on anything in the email. You contact them the way you would contact them if you were trying to get in touch with them. Oh my goodness, there's just more and more of these. It turns out there's probably no limit to how many you can get of these. Here's one that's first 5 people. Hello, I have a charity fund worth $4,200,000, blah, blah, blah. The first 5 people can donate. So, oh, darn, I wasn't one of the first 5 people to donate to your new charity. Well, what, do I get a discount on your charity because I donated early? Undisclosed recipients, that's the indefinite list of, I'm not telling you who it's going to, but you're one of the many, and so forth. So hopefully this is just a very short tutorial on hundreds and hundreds of these things that I just got in the last couple of weeks. I did want to mention one other thing that I've seen a lot recently. I think what they're trying to do is prevent the spam filters from detecting them. So what they're doing is taking two or three letters at a time and putting a space in between them. So this one says, American, senior discount, you didn't, blah, blah, blah. Only it's AM space, ER space, I space, CAN space, and so forth. They're putting spaces in the middle of the words because they think that that will cause, I believe, the spam filters to not detect that it's spam. But of course, if they have all these non-words, probably the spam filters have figured out by now that that's probably spam. Every week, we'll feature another cyber fraud to help keep you aware of what's going on and what you can do about it. If you'd like to read the book, Fraud, Spies, and Lies, and How to Defeat Them, it's available online at all.net under books. That's ALL.NET, and you press on books. Fred here. On April 4th, we have our monthly advisory call for Angel to Exit. Join us to discuss anything you want about your early stage company. Later that day, we'll have the CEO's Forum, where portfolio company CEOs get together and discuss issues and help each other identify synergistic improvements. On April 11th, go to Angel. You can pitch your company, get in front of investors, get on the radio show, and tell the world about your new company. Also on April 11th, the All.net Members Forum. You can meet with cybersecurity experts from around the world and discuss all sorts of interesting things. For more details, go to thecybershow.co.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.
We're talking with Simpson here, who has a long career, both as a cybersecurity, we'll call it threat actor for the moment, and as a journalist. Okay, Simpson, welcome back. So after you wrote a computer virus in the 1970s and did not get arrested for it, and nobody knew about it until just now when you explained it, except the people that had to clean it up that didn't know what it was either. So let's move on. What happened next?
Well, it didn't attach itself to anything. It was just self-replicating, right? So,
but that's it's still a computer virus, right? Doesn't have to, you know, the technical definition, you can't differentiate between whether it infects something else or just reproduces. Reproduction okay. is not a problem.
Okay. All right. Point taken. Yeah, I did one of those at MIT Project Athena, too. I went to MIT in 1983. And MIT had just announced a deal with Digital Equipment and IBM to computerize the campus and install the campus network. And I was a chemistry major because I had done most of my chemistry stuff at Bryn Mawr College. And I was still really interested in computers. So I did a job writing software to connect an IBM PC to a photo spectrometer, an ultraviolet spectrophotometer. And that was fun, but it was boring because I was like all in a room by myself and nobody else was there. But I also had an account on Project Athena. And one day I noticed that you could edit the man pages. Like if you would like type man and then like, you know, LS, it would show you the LS manual page. And if you typed E, it would take you into the editor and you could actually edit the manual page. And I knew that was like wrong.
Oops.
So I reported it because at this point I was like not, I knew that like you could get in trouble at that point.
Well, was it just that you could get in trouble or was it also that you could actually do some harm by making it so that they typed the wrong thing?
I was more worried about getting in trouble.
Trouble. Okay. There you go.
So so there's another computer worm I did, which is it turns out that we had this whole network of Unix machines, and I realized that you could write a program that copied itself to another computer and then executed itself remotely. And I thought that was really cool. And so I did that, right? And I realized that if I didn't put a timeout in it or something, it would just crash every computer on the whole network, and that would be bad. So I did this at like 11:50 at night, and I set it up so that when the day changed to 12 midnight, all the copies that were running would automatically stop. And so I set it going, and like the computers all started getting slower and slower and slower, and because you know I made that standard mistake that somebody else made, which is I didn't check to see if the machine was already infected before I logged into it to reinfect it.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
So it's a common mistake with people who write these computer worms, it turns out.
You have to think about what you're doing.
But then midnight comes, and I'm starting to sweat, right? Because I'm like, oh, shit. Yeah,
right.
But then midnight comes around, and they all die. And so I'm like,
well, you said they stopped. Did they delete themselves or they just stopped?
No, but it was all in my home directory. Like, it would have been really easy to know it was me, right? So
they're
all running under my username, right? So
So it's easy to identify these.
Yes, absolutely. I'm not really into the stealth thing, you know. So that was a lot of fun, but the serious thing I want to say is that the whole time that I was in high school and the whole time I was taking classes at Bryn Mawr, and really the whole time I was at MIT, the fundamental continuity of all these is that I just kept having bad advising again and again and again. It's something that we do very badly in academia. We don't give students actionable advice on what they should do with their skills. Professor in the chemistry department wanted me to work in his research lab and do his research in chemistry. They wanted me to work on this instrumentation program, but nobody ever really sat down with me and talked about all the range of opportunities and what required research and what were hard problems and what were easy problems. So I never really did a lot of principled learning. I never learned the basics in computing my entire time as an undergraduate. I took two courses in computer science department, but I knew how to program, and so I thought I didn't need to learn anything else about computer science because I was a pretty good programmer. And so I see that as a lot of missed opportunities. It was my fault, but it really was the fault of the system. I was at a premier institution, and still the advising was really, really bad.
But also you were in the chemistry department. So, I mean, I was an electrical engineer when I was at university, and I only ever took one computer course.
Right. And the first thing my advisor...
But I was also a nighttime operator on the computers, right. And I also, ended up working as a professional programming things while I was at the university. But
the very first thing my advisor should have said is, you're in the wrong department.
I don't know if they,
Well,
I'm not
have.
Sure that they were that wise. Okay.
At MIT, you can easily move from department to department.
But it's not about your ability to do it. It's about their
understanding
you. Yeah.
So I took the intro to computer programming, intro to computer system 6001. I took the architecture course 6004. I took the telephony course. I had a blast with all of them. And the other thing is, I was really afraid to take the math courses. So I didn't take a single math course as an undergraduate. And at the time, you needed to take this differential equations course 6002, which is all about E&M and differential equations. And I had a really hard time in physics, the two
physics. Well, I think that dyslexia probably has something to do with that as well.
Oh, maybe. I was just...
math, even though we have the transitive property, it's still, it's not always applicable. Okay. Are you starting to see some themes in this person?
Yes. Right. I love all the peoples, right? It's a fascinating referential frame.
I'm astonished by his ability to remember course numbers.
I was doing the same thing.
70s, my God. I had 703, but 704 wasn't that fun. But in 705, I took, oh my goodness. So there's tremendous memory, tremendous recall, but there seems to be a constant ethical gap, and it's really tricky for him. And when you think about it, he's a very successful person. He's done all sorts of good things, but his motivations all seem to be sort of on the side of do anything because you enjoy it. On the other hand, I'm afraid of, going to jail, so I won't do the things that I would otherwise do.
Well, in today's, I don't know, Simpson, you don't want to get into psychology at this point, but, I'm deeply in the spectrum we're all in, right? And you and I, in all our conversations, right? It's a time-based world, right? We focus on different skill sets and innate capabilities and so forth, and Simpson obviously has lots of innate skills. And how we navigate through this, again, I don't see I don't see someone, you know, ethically flawed. You know, I see somebody working on logical constructs and, again, doesn't seem to have done great harm and has done great good in the world.
No, it's not about ethically flawed, right? I'm unconvinced that we know what that means. Well, I think it's fascinating to explore the driving factors.
Yeah, I search the world for ill intent and I don't find it basically almost anywhere, right? You know, and I don't find it here, right? It's curiosity and sometimes that means breaking things and, you know, how we value other structures is its own thing.
Well, yeah. The other thing is, you know, what is it? Unintended consequences, right? So, you know, the unintended, I forgot about this thing. I didn't think of that. And now it's running wild.
Welcome to my world.
You know, it's collapsing everything. And you know, I could be in big trouble, blah, blah, blah. And then, oh, thank goodness it saved itself, right? And after the fact, you know, so I guess what we don't want is medical doctors that are that way.
I don't know. I see a lot of myself in that. You know, me in these boats, you know, the 7-mile storm, you know, when I've got no electricity in the middle of the night, you know, in the worst possible spot I might sail up from the Keys, you know, all planned out perfectly fine, and storms sometimes just happen. You know, so
is this really how the world advances?
Yes.
So what happens is, you know, explorers, right? When we talk about hacking, we're talking about exploring for the large part, right? It's personal exploration. It's not the official authorized exploration. It's personal exploration. And we're going to try stuff and see what happens. And we think we're doing it safely and we think we're doing it reasonably, but oops, get pretty close and you back off. Okay, there's a mistake I won't make again. And then you start to worry about other mistakes you might make related to that, right? So it's the near misses that cause you to figure things out. Is that basically
right? I love the whole spirit of hacking, right? You know, hacking versus engineering. You know, engineering is starting with a blank piece of paper and saying, all right, I need to build something and I'm going to use, kind of find and make the components to make that thing. Hacking is looking at a full sheet of paper. Say that the world is already the way it is. You know, what happens when I push on this? How does that work? This is connected to that. What if I build a couple of boats and I'm going to sail them slowly and stay in this shallow water using solar power and blah, 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 right? You know, do things that hadn't been done before with existing stuff. There's, you know, less invention, more integration.
So I think engineering largely takes existing parts and, right. You know, it's applied math and applied physics. Because I'm an engineer, I probably have a different view of it, right? But I also hack things together, right? So I didn't have formal computer programming experience, but I like, you know, I write lots of programs and I read lots of books about it and so forth. And I still write programs. The difference is the analysis that goes into it, right? That is, to do a good job of engineering something, you really need to be thorough in your thought process. You need to look at the history. You need to understand all the things that can go wrong. And that's the reasonable and prudent thing, as opposed to the, you know, I'm doing something that's non-critical. And I'm going to try something out to see how it works. And, oh, that's interesting how it works. I'm going to play with it some more and push it a little bit here and, you know, a little bit there. And then it becomes more and more interesting as you try more and more things. One of the problems that's been historically identified, I guess, by a lot of people is that, especially in the software domain, you know, you build the first one and you keep evolving and evolving and evolving and you never go back and rewrite it, right? And that's why we get this ridiculous crap. But one of the interesting things is...
That's a technical term.
Yeah, it's just very specific. One of the interesting things is we actually do rewrite things, right? So Y2K, you know, that right around year 2000, a lot of stuff that was, you know, because of the rollover of the year, potentially problematic, got rewritten. A lot of things got rewritten in different languages, right? So when you rewrite it in a different language, you're actually taking what exists and trying to restructure it, rewrite it, and so forth. And so there is some of this activity over the long term. And we're looking at a rail crisis, especially with, you know, one of the rail companies. You know, they have, you know, 5 crashes in the last 4 weeks or some ridiculous, you know, horrible thing. And, you know, the government's looking at changing the regulations. Look, think about air flight, right? The FAA and National Transportation Safety Board, who have evolved the rules over time to get the accidents down to just about as close to zero as you can get. And yet they've had near misses. So they're going to start pushing on that really hard again, right? Those near misses, those are the things that teach you how to do something better. On the trains, we're getting derailments. We're not getting near misses. We're getting, you know, people dying and, you know, crashes and damage to the environment. So that needs to get perfected more. So it turns into an engineering discipline. And I think one of the problems here is that in the train space, it's thought of as old tech. And because it's so old, we're really not thinking about it anymore. We're sort of assuming we know how. And that's a mistake in the United States. A lot of the rest of the world is going to, you know, very high speed trains. So those are very specifically engineered. You know, they have very different tolerances on things, a lot more care, a lot more maintenance. And so this is one of the things where the U.S., for example, has just fallen behind in its rail infrastructure. And I think related to that is, you know, we've tossed out the engineering interest and discipline associated with it. And, you know, we're not being as careful and we're not trying to push the edge. So I think it's very important to push the edge. But I think hacking is exploration. And engineering is making it so it's very reliable, increasingly carefully reliable. And you need them both, right?
Well, and I think, you know, to appreciate where the hacking opportunities are, we need to understand the maturity levels of things, right? And, you know, I love the rail system as a, you know, train kid, you know, collecting spikes and everything else. But this is a short history. Like, no, that's ancient technology. No, that's a lifetime or two. Right. You know, it was 150 years ago or so. You know, we're still developing that, you know, and I'm sure if you went back and talked to the best rail engineers of the 1890s, you know, they bring up topics that we're still not yet quite implementing because it takes a long time. Sorry.
Yeah, I wish it didn't, because I'm one of those people that thinks if things change faster, it'd be better. But, you know, so it goes.
We're talking to Doug, who has spent a lifetime dealing with the issues of identity management and has consulted for many of the largest enterprises in the world in this arena. So we're back with Doug. And when we were talking last time, you were this odd duck at IBM, sort of the between the salesperson and the technologist doing the translations and also then figuring out how to actually price things.
Yeah.
And I don't know, did they used to call that like a sales engineer or something?
Actually, was it was called a system, an SE, systems engineer.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yep.
So you were a systems engineer.
Yeah.
And at some point, you no longer did that for IBM. So what happened between you and IBM that caused that change?
I got tired of seeing the salespeople I was working with pull up in brand new BMWs and Mercedes. They were making a ton of money off of the work that I was doing for them. They were nice to me and everything, but I was still getting an SE salary. And I said, wait a minute, I think I can do better than that. I had an opportunity at that point with somebody that I worked with when I was at IBM to join her one-person company. It was Sarah Radicati. She was actually one of the original designers of the X.500 protocol. So she knew a lot about X.500, but again, she didn't have the kind of street smarts, if you will, that I had for deployment. So I went to work for her, maintained the same job. I essentially stayed a systems engineer, but now I no longer had to sell or help sell IBM products. I was able to dive deep into a whole plethora of products that were coming out at that point in time. Most notably were two, Novell with NetWare directory storage.
Goodness gracious, yeah.
Yep.
Novell was the winner at the time, but of course they weren't using TCP/IP, so that they were going to die from that.
They were going to die. But Microsoft, one of the first projects Sarah and I worked on was to do a deep dive evaluation of Active Directory, the very first Active Directory, not even 1.0, you know, a pre.
Yeah, yeah. 0.3.
Yeah. Yep. So I remember spending a few months just diving into Active Directory and comparing that to everything I knew about now the LDAP. You know, the LDAP, it was, I think it was still V2, version 2.
And yeah, what does LDAP stand for again?
Hmm?
What does LDAP stand for?
Lightweight Directory Access Protocol.
There you go.
Yep.
So, but just so everybody knows, a protocol is a way to communicate between parties, right? It's a systematic communications exchange approach.
Well, and that was the beauty. It was really, I'd say, the dawning of the API kind of or application programming interface.
Thank you.
Yep. Of the application programming interface or API means of writing applications that could use a, how should I say, general purpose repository to look things up during runtime and make, guess what, authentication and access control decisions.
Okay, so now let's talk about this, because this is really the same thing as what a database does all the time, right?
Absolutely correct, yes.
Yeah, so a database, when you talk about an application program, an API, because now we've said it like eight times, we don't have to say it every time.
You have an API to a database. So that's basically what the language for communicating with databases is an API, right?
Right. The big difference is the schema of the database was essentially the OSI International Standard Database Schema for objects. They called object classes of people and things and applications and systems and services. So it was tailor-made. I don't even think the world saw it coming that when the World Wide Web came alive in 93 and 94, just at that point in time, the whole LDAP and directory services community was becoming mature enough to be able to support the web to start doing things like authentication and authorization, looking up attributes, looking at passwords, and then looking at group memberships or other attributes about the person in the repository in a standardized way as per the schema that any application developer could then use. So you don't have to know a special purpose schema. Go ahead.
So now this is like completely the opposite of the direction of computing and computer science over history, right? So that almost always computers go from the specific to the general. So you write a program, it's got specific values for things, then you generalize it. And then once it's sort of working and becomes popular, you generalize it more. So it has more things it can do and more things. Databases were sort of the most generic. You can store anything in any different way. You can look it up in different ways.
Yeah.
And this is the opposite. This is taking that general purpose and turning it into that customized, crush it down into the just the things you need for what seems like it's an application that's it's this little teeny application. But that teeny application, you know, sort of became a little bit bigger. And we're going to talk about that next segment. Okay, there you go. So going exactly the opposite of what everybody else is doing. Instead of having this general purpose approach, you're going to narrow it down. And that all of a sudden changes everything because you now start to structure decision making on a global basis based on a limited number of parameters. Instead of saying everything can be anything, it's now a common agreement on how you identify what's associated with what and how you authorize one thing to another for use.
You know, and I have to think of this, and we always think of things through our current context and the digital bill of materials, right? You know, attestation infrastructure that was just launched officially this week through the Lonnie Foundation. We've been working on for the last 4 years. And it's fascinating trying to explain this to people because to your point here, it's really, really simple. It does really, really simple, structural, fundamental things. But people are trying to solve complex problems. In this case, you know, how do we share, you know, supply chain intelligence, you know, globally and fractally and so on and so forth. And we're all wrapped up in all these complex issues. And sometimes taking a very simple part of something out, you know, can help a lot because, you know, with the functions that does, you can now go back to the bigger problem and say, all right, you know, now that's actually, you know, we've mowed the lawn a little bit, you've cut it into pieces.
So what's interesting along these lines to me is that this is one of many such things. So in the early days, the whole goal was to build general purpose capacity so we could do stuff, so we could figure out how to do anything. And what you see is the opposite trend now, right? The trend is to get away from that anything can do anything anywhere always into applications, right? So now on your phone or on your iPad or on your whatever, your device, you're downloading an application that has a specific thing that it does, and it uses specific protocols to communicate with other things. And so it's becoming smaller, less capable modules combining together to perform the overall functions, which I think makes it more manageable to understand what's going on in the perimeter of what you're doing, because we keep building up these structures on top of each other, and the complexity will just become completely unmanageable if they're all general purpose, talking to anybody, anywhere, anytime, in any way.
Well, you know, there's certain things that stand out to me is when people use singular terms in massive context. You know, in supply chain intelligence, SBOM, software bill of materials, is the topic these days. And you keep hearing this coming up in interesting and telling ways, right? You know, where's the repository going to be? Not the repositories, like just any N number of repositories maintained by Y people for Z reasons, you know, interconnected, however.
Yeah, it's a distributed world, and we keep talking about centers, right? So this is good, right? So they talk about centers of excellence in computer security. So the National Security Agency has centers of excellence, and there are probably 50 centers of excellence. Well, it's not the center anymore, guys, right?
And satellites, you know, as like in a client server sort of mainframe. Yeah, no, actually, this is interconnected. There are patterns inside. The basic network is steel wool, right? You know, you're not there to figure out actually how it all connects together. You're there to use things on it.
Right. And this was the architectural decision from the beginning with the ARPANET. The Advanced Research Projects Agency was moving away from those centralized systems into a distributed network to survive nuclear attack. That's what that was about. Allow survivable communications where things could get automatically rerouted and storage wasn't centralized and so forth. And as that moved on into the internet, it became more so. And the very term, the web, that's what it is. It's a web of stuff, right? It's not one thing, one place. It's a whole bunch of stuff all over the place, and it's largely survivable. There are some things that are left in it, though. One of them is DNS, the domain name system.
Yep.
And another one is the, well, it's not quite the same, but the whole way autonomous systems work. So the BGP, Border Gateway Protocol, between autonomous systems, this causes widespread collapses because by infusing information into the border gateways, you can tell everybody in the internet to route everything through you, which has happened several times, accidentally or otherwise, with several, I think, North Korea and China and so forth. So, and then all of these failures that you see that are massive come from the aggregation of risk from one person that's authorized, whether intentionally or as a side effect of the way things are working, authorized to make changes in critical systems. So Facebook goes down for 8, 10, 12 hours, and the whole thing goes down because one engineer made one mistake in typing in a parameter to Border Gateway Protocol, and they didn't have enough redundancy to take care of it.
Because we're still on the path, right? You know, and you know, this, you know, think about the last segment here with Doug. You know, at that time, early 90s, you know, IBM had AIX. You know, I was in Toronto at a Unix convention, and there was a 64-year-old guy from, you know, 40 years at IBM, and he was just so smug with the idea that, you know, goading us and saying, oh, open systems are great as long as they're entirely proprietary.
Yeah, now, right. IBM proprietary open, right? What does that exactly mean?
Right. Yeah. So obviously it's like, oh, we have an open system, wink, wink, right? And that was the standard, you know, in 1990. Today, IBM owns Red Hat, right? And we're still working through how you have truly open systems and maintain your intellectual property and so on and so forth. It takes a long time. So federated systems like BGP and everything else, we're still working on it.
There's another, I think, very important issue with that. And that is, there's a fundamental unfairness associated with the way these open systems are done. These, you know, sort of 50 people, 100, 1,000 people contribute to a new product that's out there that's free, right? It's been made available. It's made in the public domain. Anybody can do it. And then the people that made it, who are controlling it, go into a private business and they exploit that. And they still
keep someone else does.
Well, I understand. Yeah. They still keep the open source version out there under their control, but now they create their for sale version. And then they make money on the support of it. And the problem is not that that's how it works. I understand that's how it works. But the people who come into this at the bottom, who believe they're doing something good for the world and that we're all sharing with each other, they spend 5, 10, 15 years and then come to the realization that they've been taken advantage of. They spent years of time and effort and fixed and all sorts of effort in this thing. And now that's being decimated and somebody is making a lot of money out of it and they got nothing for all their time and effort. So this is the same as the problem with copyrights and patents and this challenge between this private ownership and the public good. There's no set of rewards in place for people working for the public good, except for the personal, you know, feeling of that it's good that I did it, right? There's no monetary awards. And, you know, people get old and get tired and end up poor and, you know, living in squalor or, you know, dying of some disease they don't have to die of because they weren't sufficiently greedy or they bought into this vision.
Well, you know, there's so many layers to that, you know, but I think, you know, to my point, in the early 1990s, corporations started to say, wink, wink, we believe in open systems. And then the internet happened. And, you know, even today, you know, the nod and the wink is there in some cases, right? You know, I've been the big corporate person turn of the century. I was always trying to be ethical, but I was perfectly happy saying, look, we're spending shareholder money to develop these features and so forth. And we want people to buy Cisco stuff. However, right, you know, you also have to engage with open standards and make sure things are really interoperable. So if you have to do something early, you know, and you make a profit off that, great, but still. Anyways, my point is, I think we're still on the curve along actually believing all of this. Not just open systems, but the whole thing. Free speech and you know, democracy and capitalism and open systems, all of this individual aggregate, you know, self-forming stuff. You know, since the French Revolution and before, we've been, you know, thinking about this and we're still working on it.
So when you talk about cryptocurrency, they keep saying a democratization, right? The distribution of this stuff makes it all democratic. No, it's not democratic, and you're ripping us off. And a lot of times people say democratization when it's in fact anarchization. What they're favoring is anarchy, and they don't understand that anarchy is the worst of all, right? That's when people just go crazy and kill each other and take advantage of each other with no controls whatsoever. Next week on The Cyber Show. Another pitcher tries to hit a home run. Peter talks ethics, or the lack thereof. More fraud, spies, and lies. Simpson eats hot chili peppers to be macho. Doug gets into group sects. And who knows what else. See you next week on The Cyber Show.
A good time at Bow. A good time at Bow. A string beating man and a fiddler for a band.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.